leaks. In the same segment, however, Legit's superior NSA chief Keith Alexander said he opposes amnesty for Snowden.
This is analogous to a hostage taker taking 50 people hostage, shooting 10, and then say, if you give me full amnesty, I'll let the other 40 go. What do you do?
It's a dilemma.
It is.
Do you have a pick?
I do. I think people have to be held accountable for their actions. Because what we don't want is the next person to do the same thing, race off to Hong Kong and to Moscow with another set of data, knowing they can strike the same deal.
According to the New York Times, NSA officials reviewing the Snowden leaks are still unaware of exactly how much information he took from their systems. A Kansas airport technician was arrested Friday after trying to carry out an alleged bomb plot. Prosecutors say Terry Lowen used his security access to drive a truck he thought was carrying explosives onto the tarmac of the Mid-Continent Airport in Wichita. But the explosives had been built with undercover FBI agents who ensured they were inert.
The criminal complaint, which was filed today in U.S. Federal District Court, alleges that Mr. Lowen spent months developing a plan to use his access card to the airport to drive a car loaded with explosives to the terminal. It's alleged that he planned to pull the trigger on the explosives himself and die in the explosion as a martyr. Agents arrested him at about 5:40 a.m. as he attempted to use his access card to enter the tarmac and to deliver the vehicle loaded with what he believed to be high explosives.
As in previous cases that have raised questions of entrapment, the FBI agents who posed as Lowen's accomplices supplied him with the materials he thought were bombs. Lowen said to have been a Muslim convert who was radicalized by leading jihadist websites. He left a note for his family saying he intended to cause maximum carnage and death. The White House faced scrutiny over the weekend following the revelation a missing American captured in Iran was working for the CIA. Robert Levinson disappeared in 2007 after arriving on the Iranian island of Kish to spy on the Iranian government. The CIA told Congress and the FBI he did not have a relationship to the agency at the time, but it emerged last week Levinson went to Iran at the behest of CIA analysts. On Friday, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney avoided questions on Levinson's CIA ties.
Bob Levinson was not a U.S. government employee when he went missing in Iran. As there is an ongoing investigation into his disappearance, I am not going to comment further on what he may or may not have been doing in Iran. I'm not going to fact check every allegation made in the story you reference, a story we believe it was highly irresponsible to publish and which we strongly urged the outlet not to publish out of concerns for Mr. Levinson's safety. I'm also not going to say anything that might further harm our efforts to bring Mr. Levinson home safe, which has been our goal for the 6.5 years he has been missing.
The White House can apparently claim Levinson did not work for the U.S. government because he was technically a CIA contractor. There has been no sign Levinson is alive for nearly 3 years. The Obama administration says it continues to seek Levinson's return through a number of different channels. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
On May 16, 2008, KABU was granted a license by the Federal Communications Commission to serve the public interest as a public trustee until February 1, 2014. Our license will expire on February 1, 2014. We filed an application for license renewal with the FCC. A copy of this application is available for public inspection during our regular business hours. It contains information concerning the station's performance since May 16, 2008. Individuals who wish to advise the FCC of facts relating to our renewal application and to whether the station has operated in the public interest should file comments and petitions with the Commission by January 2, 2014. Further information concerning the Commission's broadcast license renewal process is available at KABU Studios at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214, or may be obtained from the FCC, Washington, D.C. 20554.
The time is 5:05, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 Community Radio. Up next is the evening news. At 6:30 will be From 5 to 6 is the evening news. At 6:30 will be Labor Radio, and at 6 will be Labor Radio, excuse me, and at 6:30 will be Prison Pipeline. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizzas, salads, and wraps, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland. They can be reached on the phone at area code 503-232-5511 or online at laurelhursttheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a federal judge has ruled that widespread NSA wiretapping is unconstitutional.
Oregon will delay a $20 million payment to the Oracle Corporation until the Cover Oregon healthcare website is functioning correctly.
Governor Kitzhaber launches his campaign for re-election, and his biggest donors so far have been from the timber industry. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 16th, 2013. I'm Sam.
And I'm Ross. The state of Oregon has been ranked dead last in its rollout of the Affordable Care Act, according to a report by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. In the first 2 months of the program, only 44 Oregonians were able to enroll in private coverage through Cover Oregon. The head of the program took a medical leave this month after coming under fire for the troubled rollout. And the acting head of the program, Bruce Goldberg, today announced that a $20 million payment to the Oracle Corporation has been delayed until the company fixes the problems with the Cover Oregon website. Goldberg addressed media questions at a press conference today.
As we determine that people are eligible for coverage, as we process their applications, as they come through our system, we're letting them know within 24 hours. We're calling them and actually walking through plan choices with them. In addition, next week we're going to have some enrollment fairs in three locations around the state, in Bend, in Eugene, and in Portland, to help people with their choices. I think, unfortunately, as you know, about half of the applications we received were incomplete. We have already reached out to many of those consumers, letting them know that their applications are incomplete. And we'll be calling and letting people know through phone calls and emails that if their application was incomplete on December 4th, that they won't be able to get coverage through Cover Oregon until their applications are complete.
Do you feel that of the applications that were made through December 4th, and I think you said there are 25 to 30,000 of those you're working on now, will those be completed by the December in time for the 27th? Deadline?
We're doing everything we can to make certain that they are. We've added staff. We're continuing to work at doing that. It's something that we're going to do our best to achieve.
What's the situation with Oracle right now as far as the website is concerned?
The situation with Oracle is they continue to work as our contractor to get the website up and going. We're withholding payments from them while they do that work, and we're working with them to be certain that as I indicated, we're bringing on some additional quality control help to be certain that we work through all the items that need to get worked out and can get this website up and going.
Are you satisfied with their response?
I am not satisfied with the fact that we don't have a website up and going today. That's what we had wanted to be. Certainly, we're not where we want to be. And in the end, This is about having an operational website, and until we have one, I'm not going to be satisfied.
How did Oracle get this contract? Was it through a competitive RFP, or were they already doing other website work for the state and were asked to simply segue in to cover Oregon? How did they get this contract?
There was an extended period of going out, looking for bidders for the contract. This was, I believe, back in 2010. And there were vendor fairs. There was several organizations that the state had hired to oversee that process to solicit vendors and be able to evaluate them through what's called a vendor fair process. In the end, it came down to, my recollection is there were two vendors that were felt to have the ability to do the work as was being specified, and Oracle got the contract.
That was Bruce Goldberg, the acting head of Oregon's healthcare exchange, known as Cover Oregon, speaking at a press conference today about the ongoing problems with the rollout of the Cover Oregon healthcare exchange website.
Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber has begun to collect campaign contributions for his upcoming bid for re-election, and the biggest contributor so far is the timber industry. Kitzhaber has received $85,000 from timber companies across Oregon in the last week. During his current term in office, Kitzhaber submitted legislation to the federal court system to increase timber production in western Oregon. The Democratic governor has ties with environmental groups in addition to his connection with the timber industry in Oregon. He has now acquired over $300,000 toward his re-election campaign, less than 1 week after announcing his bid for re-election for an historic fourth term. Kitzhaber claims he's running again so he can continue to work on state health care to reduce Oregon's carbon footprint and to create new jobs.
Governor John Kitzhaber promised to put a price on carbon emissions when he signed a regional climate change agreement earlier this year in October. Similar programs exist in both California and British Columbia, but lawmakers in Oregon are unsure of the best way to implement a carbon trading system. $200,000 from the general fund was allocated by state legislators for a study conducted by the Northwest Economic Research Center on what a carbon tax or fee might be like. The model would show the impacts on the different economic segments and geographical parts of the state. The state's goal is to drastically reduce greenhouse gas emissions. State officials expect that by 2020, Oregon will reduce emissions by 10% below 1990 levels, and by 2050, reduce them by 75%. The tax would create new state revenue and also provide corporate tax cuts, low-income tax relief, and targeted investments in certain industries. A final analysis is expected from the Northwest Economic Research Center in November 2014.
The Multnomah County Circuit Court has ruled in favor of the environmental group Oregon Wild in its bid to post an anti-logging advertisement at the Portland Airport. The Port of Portland originally refused to display the ad, claiming that its content was politically biased. The advertisement questions the legislation that would double the amount of logging allowed on federal timber land in western Oregon. The ad shows a bare hill covered in tree stumps saying, quote, "Welcome to Oregon, home of the clear cut," unquote. The federal constitution allows government agencies to refuse politically based advertising, but the Oregon constitution provides greater free speech protection, claiming that government agencies are not allowed to distinguish between two types of speech based on the content of the speech.
A Southern Oregon school district has one of the highest rates of student poverty in the United States. The U.S. Census Bureau this week released a spreadsheet of poverty levels among school districts in the U.S. The Bureau estimates that close to 125,000 Oregon children between the ages of 5 and 17 are from families whose income is below the poverty line. The school district of Port Orford Langless in Curry County ranks near the bottom of the list nationwide. 55% of the 330 children in the district are from households earning less than the poverty threshold. The numbers reflect a struggling economy in a rural area dependent on fishing, timber, and farming. Two other districts in Southwest Oregon have high student poverty rates, with a 37% poverty rate at Myrtle Point and 32% at Reedsport. Among larger Oregon school districts, high child poverty rates were found in Ontario in eastern Oregon, Woodburn in Marion County, and David Douglas in the Portland area. The large Salem-Keizer School District is home to more impoverished school-aged children than any other in Oregon, with nearly 11,000 children living in poverty. The wealthiest school districts in Oregon were all in the Portland suburbs, Sherwood, Lake Oswego, Colton, and West Lynn, Wilsonville.
In December of 2011, Occupy activist Colonel Moses started the vigil to end homelessness in front of Portland City Hall. The vigil witnessed rallies, sleep-ins, and hunger strikes, but couldn't withstand the relentless assault of Portland Mayor Charlie Hales. KBOO's Joe Meyer was at City Hall earlier today and filed this report.
Shortly after Portland's Occupy camps were cleared out, the vigil to end homelessness started in front of City Hall. This vigil served as a political protest as well as a safe place to sleep. I asked a few of your neighbors what they thought about the city's removal of the vigil.
Be honest with you, dude. I mean, we should have rights, you know what I mean? You know, as a city in Portland, I mean, they're against us sleeping under bridges, so we sleep on the sidewalk and get tarps and, you know, get ourselves out of the rain, or you get poured on, have a chance to get flooded out. I mean, why not? You know what I mean? Like, it's more than just sleeping there. I mean, I think we were trying to make a point, you know what I'm saying? It needs to be more about community, like, you know, and I think the community at large, like, at large, I mean, we've actually been able to like, I've just seen a lot of cool stuff happen, you know, people in houses and just, like, people coming together, and all just from people just sleeping where it's not really convenient to sleep, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, it's more convenient. It's much better, in my opinion. It looks better. It's more comfortable to be around.
Where do you think those guys have gone?
You know, sometimes I see under the bridge at night, but I am not sure. I was wondering what happened, what they were relocated or not.
Actually, they didn't bother me. I think those news bins are just as trashy as, a matter of fact, trashier than a human being. I don't see how a human could make that look any worse. You know what I mean? That looks terrible to me. If you want to know something being in the way, that's in the way. Even though it might be bringing something helpful, it's still in the way. That person probably got more to offer than that bin right there. Why can't a person sit right there?
Hi, I'm Joe Meyer with KBOO News. Can I ask you two questions? You don't even have to stop walking. Remember, people used to sleep out here. Do you like it better this way?
It's cleaner.
It's cleaner. So you think Hales did a good thing in clearing people out of here? Or?
Yes.
Yeah? Where do you think they are now?
In our parks.
In our parks? How do you like that?
If they're comfortable.
So just basically not on the sidewalks?
Not on the sidewalks. They were being rude to people and a little disrespectful.
Any good solutions that you see? I know R2-D2's in the news, or...
Yeah, I don't. You know, they just... Housing, you know, is what we always want. So, you know, so But unless that happens.
I know it wasn't often pretty out here. However, what about their political right to be here?
You know, they could say their political statement, but, you know, again, you know, you've got people that are still offending other people. I mean, it was just... That's all it was. So they can have their political rights as long as they're being nice.
Do you remember people used to sleep out here a lot?
I saw that, yeah.
Was it bothering you when they were here?
Not at all.
Did people harass you or?
No, not at all. Actually, a lot of them were really friendly and, you know, like just kept to themselves and tried to, you know, like stay warm or stay sheltered and stuff. So, yeah, it didn't bother me at all.
Those were some of your neighbors out in front of City Hall today when asked what they thought about the vigil that's no longer there. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
All shellfish imports from the U.S. West Coast to China have been suspended by the Chinese government after geoduck clams were found to contain high levels of arsenic and another toxin that caused paralytic shellfish poisoning. There are fears that the shutdown of the biggest Pacific Northwest export could last for months. U.S. officials think the contaminated shellfish came from Washington State or Alaska, but they are waiting for the Chinese government to send details. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration stopped issuing export certifications and is attempting to negotiate with the Chinese government to reach an agreement. Last year, the U.S. exported $68 million worth of geoduck clams that mostly came from the Washington State Puget Sound region, and about 90% of them went to China. Approximately 5 million pounds of the clams are caught each year. Geoduck clams sell for $100 to $150 per pound in China, and while they are sold year-round, the demand is higher during the holiday season. Approximately 2,000 divers are out of work because of the ban, and more jobs are in trouble if the ban isn't lifted soon.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. After today's broadcast, Jimmy Tardy talks with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch and Shauna Curfee of the National Lawyers Guild. They will discuss City Hall's response to the U.S. Department of Justice finding a pattern of abuse among the Portland police toward people experiencing mental health issues. Opportunities for citizen involvement are at hand. At 6, it is Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather forecast calls for a 50% chance of rain with a high temperature of 46 degrees. Tonight's low temperature in Portland is forecast at 33 degrees under mostly clear skies.
In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 33 counts per minute in North Portland with a high peaking at 55. In Raleigh Hills, it's 29 CPM with a high of 37. Powell Butte measured 28 CPM with no high register. Medford, Oregon has 33 CPM with a high of 48. Seattle, Washington has 30 CPM with a high of 45. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 35 counts per minute with spikes up to 55. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. It's 5:23. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The scandalous saga of the Wall Street bailout continues, for bank regulators are now watering down Congress's pathetically weak reforms. However, during the past 4 years, one fellow has shown some regulatory backbone, proposing rules to prevent a repeat of the whole sorry saga. He is Gary Gensler, head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and he's dared to push the Treasury Secretary and other major bank overseers to join him in seriously limiting Wall Street's cavalier proliferation of complex derivatives. Analysts describe these convoluted schemes as poorly disclosed, poorly understood, and could lay waste to the economy. Good for Gensler, right? Yes, but of all the agency heads who are involved in writing new banking rules, guess which one was not invited this year by President Obama to stay on the job? Yes, the tough one, the one actually trying to protect the people, the one not afraid to offend Wall Street greed heads, Gary Gensler. He's being replaced by Timothy Massad, who appears to be more of an industry lapdog than a watchdog. Massad, a career insider, has been a corporate lawyer for banks, a lickspittle lieutenant for Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, himself an infamous Wall Street softy, and a blocker of tough provisions to stop big banks from unfairly squeezing hard-hit homeowners. Apparently, Gensler wanted to keep doing his work at this once obscure agency, staying on guard against financial connivers trying to twist the rules to legalize banker robbery. But Wall Streeters certainly didn't want him there, and Obama bowed to them, displacing the one guy, the one regulatory chief, who had the guts and gumption to stand up to coddle bankers. This is Jim Hightower saying, not only is Gensler gone, but Wall Street now gets a regulator who's being entrusted to return the agency to obscurity. What a disgrace!
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
A federal judge has ruled that the National Security Agency's electronic surveillance program violates the Fourth Amendment and is unconstitutional. U.S. District Court Judge Richard Leon found that the NSA program of bulk collection of phone records and emails violates the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unreasonable search and seizure. He also said that Justice Department ad failed to demonstrate that collecting the so-called metadata helped prevent any terrorist attacks. Leon described the NSA program as indiscriminate, arbitrary, and ineffective in his written findings. But the ruling was put on hold pending an expected government appeal. The lawsuit against the NSA spying program was brought by legal activist and Judicial Watch founder Larry Klayman. The ACLU has a similar case now working its way through the courts in New York. One of these two cases will likely end up before the U.S. Supreme Court.
The group 350.org has called on alumni from U.S. universities to refuse to donate to the year-end appeals from their alma maters. They are hoping to leverage the power of alumni networks to pressure the schools to divest from fossil fuels. The group published an online video to try to encourage former students of big-name schools to send letters instead of donations this year, asking their schools to cut their ties with fossil fuel companies.
For years, we've been told that climate change is this huge problem with a simple solution. Change your light bulbs. Drive less. I think common sense told us it was going to take a lot more than that. We were set up to think that we were the bad guys.
The fossil fuel companies have in their reserves 5 times as much carbon as would be necessary to take us past 2 degrees.
If they carry out their business plan, the planet tanks.
We know who the villain is, and we know what they care about, their money and their reputation. So if we're going to win, that's what we're going after. By divesting from the fossil fuel industry, we're taking a moral stand against these companies.
It's unconscionable for our educational institution to fund climate change.
350.org says that alumni should not invest in their alma maters as long as the schools are investing in fossil fuels. They say this year-end campaign is meant to remind the universities of the ideals they stand for, the pursuit of truth, the development of a strong moral compass, and the ability to use that compass to stand up for what's right.
Deepwater oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico will be allowed to continue as the U.S. Supreme Court refused today to hear a case to put the moratorium on drilling back in place. The Obama administration initially put a moratorium on deepwater drilling after BP's massive 2010 oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The 2010 Deepwater Horizon spill was the largest in U.S. history. The moratorium was put in place in 2010 and lifted later that same year after Interior Secretary Ken Salazar claimed that new safety standards would minimize the risks related to future drilling. The Center for Biological Diversity quickly filed a lawsuit to reinstate the moratorium until a comprehensive analysis of the risks of deepwater drilling was conducted. But the Obama administration continued to give permits for deepwater drilling while the case was still in courts. Most recently, BP, the company responsible for the 2010 spill, launched 2 new deepwater drilling rigs in the Gulf of Mexico in the last month. Today's decision by the Supreme Court to not hear the case will mean that these and other drilling operations in the Gulf of Mexico will be allowed to continue.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. L&M Hospital in New London, Connecticut has agreed to resume talks Monday to end the lockout of nearly 800 union nurses and healthcare techs. The AFT locals representing the healthcare workers say it's good news for the patients and all people in the region served by the hospital. The union insisted that its entire membership be allowed to sit in on the talks, so a federal mediator will be used to shuttle proposals back and forth between the union and management. The union says the talks are expected to focus on the core issue, the future of patient care delivery at L&M Hospital and its subsidiaries.
The Milwaukee Community Coalition, backing the fast food workers movement for $15 an hour and the right to form unions, is behind an effort now to get dozens of fired McDonald's workers reinstated. The workers were abruptly fired with no explanation by the McPiles Corporation, owner of the three McDonald's stores where they worked. The boss is a capitalist pastor known in his military days as Robert McDonald's Piles. He owns at least 11 McDonald's stores in Milwaukee and is senior pastor at Milwaukee's Abundant Faith Church of Integrity. Jennifer Epps Addison is executive director of Wisconsin Jobs Now. She says the community must take a stand to get these workers back to work and demand that Pastor Piles act in accordance with his professed faith to treat these workers justly in this holiday season.
Some of them actually showed up to work and found out that they didn't have a job anymore. This is not what we expect out of any business owner, but certainly not a business owner that's a pastor right before Christmas. This is why people want unions, because the best way to resolve a difficult challenge or even hiring decisions is to sit down across from the people who are making the profits in your stores and to negotiate a fair deal for that. We hope that the union will be able to help Pastor Piles negotiate a fair deal with these workers so that everybody can have a happy holiday season and go into the new year with safe and secure families.
59 locked out Chicago area Teamsters funeral employees have won their unfair labor practices charge against Service Corporation International. The National Labor Relations Board found merit in several of the charges filed by Teamsters Local 727. But Local 727 Secretary Treasurer John Coley says that while thankful the board ruled in the workers' favor, the punishment doesn't fit the crime. Coley says the company's actions have grossly and negatively impacted the workers, and the company deserves a harsher penalty. The company had to acknowledge that they broke the law and notify the workers that they won't do it anymore. SCI has refused a Teamsters offer for the workers to return to work. The NLRB found that SCI illegally spied on union activity, threatened members with loss of vacation, and unlawfully solicited the workers to withdraw from the union. The workers have been locked out for 5 months. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A Methodist church jury has decided to strip the credentials of a minister who officiated at the wedding of his gay son. The Methodist church accepts gay and lesbian members but does not condone same-sex marriage. Reverend Frank Schaefer is among his peers as a supporter of same-sex marriage in the church and is claiming that he will no longer support them in silence. A petition written by Bishop Peggy Johnson was signed by over 19,000 members asking the church to stop holding religious trials for pastors who perform gay weddings.
Washington has... In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, Washington has extended the deadline for signing the bilateral security agreement with Afghanistan. The U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, insisted that the agreement be signed as soon as possible. Afghan President Hamid Karzai said in New Delhi on Saturday he no longer trusts the United States, accusing Americans of saying one thing and doing another. Karzai's statement to journalists came a day after he insisted he would not be intimidated into signing a security pact allowing U.S. troops in Afghanistan to stay on after next year. Also in the region, in the first attack of its kind, at least five humans were destroyed when a U.S. drone blew up a boat suspected of carrying terrorists near the Pakistan-Afghanistan border today. Officials in Pakistan's tribal belt said the attack was carried out on the Afghan side of the border. But some media reporters, however, said the strike happened inside Pakistan's Khyber tribal region.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, December 16, 2013. Israeli soldiers have invaded various Palestinian communities in different parts of the occupied West Bank and kidnapped five Palestinians. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Palestine Today. Palestinian media sources reported that Israeli troops kidnapped three Palestinians from Hijja and Jayus villages near Qalqilia in the northwest of the West Bank. The Israeli military claimed that the three were wanted for what they called security violations. Furthermore, dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded Jabaa village near the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Eyewitnesses in the village said that troops kidnapped Ibrahim Baddad, 38 years old, and Murad Malaysia, 23. The eyewitnesses said that the army forced the families out into the cold amidst the snowstorm and searched their homes. On Sunday evening, Israeli military sources reported that an Israeli soldier was shot and killed by rounds fired allegedly coming from the Lebanese side of the border by a Lebanese soldier. Israeli Daily Haaretz reported that Tel Aviv has filed an official complaint against Lebanon with the United Nations, adding that the incident will not likely lead to confrontation between Lebanon and Israel. According to Haaretz, around 8:30 p.m., while an Israeli military vehicle was patrolling a border area, around 6 to 7 rounds of live ammunition were fired, likely from a light firearm and from a relatively close range. Furthermore, the Lebanese army has reported that one of its soldiers is missing and that Israeli soldiers likely abducted him. Similar to the Israeli army, the Lebanese armed forces declared a state of emergency in the area. Also on Sunday, Israeli soldiers have violently attacked a young Palestinian man from Hebron, causing moderate injuries that required hospitalization. Another man was injured after being rammed by a military vehicle. Medical sources said that a number of Israeli soldiers violently assaulted resident Iyad Husniya from the Al-Arub refugee camp in Hebron as he was returning home. He was moved to Beit Jala Governmental Hospital in Bethlehem, suffering moderate injuries. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, December 16th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please keep visiting our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Banmoura and me, George Rishnow.
If your goal in the new year is to not get any more traffic tickets or to talk with an older parent about giving up their car keys, AARP Oregon may have you covered. The organization has programs for both situations and a newly updated smart driver course. KBOO News reporter Genevieve McDaniel worked in collaboration with Oregon News Service for more on this story.
In rural Oregon, it's the weather. In cities, add the traffic, and winter can be a tough time to be behind the wheel. AARP can't change that, but its newly revamped Smart Driver program can help people cope with those challenges and others, particularly if they're age 50 or older. AARP is a longtime provider of driver safety courses, and Oregon's chief trainer, Curtis Hansen, says new research on accidents, vehicle technology, and aging has been used to update the six-hour course.
What we try to do is to get people thinking about driving as actively as they were when they first took their driving test. Rehoning skills or rethinking about driving skills as a conscious activity instead of just jumping in the car and going down the road.
Hansen says the course isn't just for AARP members, and his students have ranged in age from 15 to 96. It is taught around the state, and there's a course locator and more information online at aarp.org/drive. Hansen says trainers don't dwell on it, but part of the course content involves older motorists knowing when to sensibly, as AARP puts it, retire from driving.
Because absent some traumatic incident, a disease or heart attack or who knows, men outlive their driving ability on average by 6 years and women on average by 10 years. So we're going to be doing other ways of getting around than driving.
Another part of the driver safety program called We Need to Talk is aimed at helping families discuss this sometimes touchy topic with aging relatives. Hansen says even people who have been driving for decades are surprised at how much some of the rules for things like safe following distances have changed, and many take the course to get a discount on car insurance.
We are also approved by the state courts and some of the municipal courts, so if a person comes in and has a not too terribly serious citation, they can come to this defensive driving course and have their fine reduced or have the ticket go away.
This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteered produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenny Kanjes, Genevieve McDaniel, Abani Ibbotson, Gabriel Idra, and Joe Meyer. The producer is Ross Freeman Levin. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews.
If you'd like to call your elected representative about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Sam.
And I'm Ross. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. At 9, on Alternative Radio, local activist Paul Cienfuegos speaks on community rights. Cienfuegos is a prominent activist in the community rights movement that works to dismantle corporate constitutional so-called rights and assert the people's right to self-governance.
At 10, hear Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, host D. May Roberts speaks with Noah Mickens of Wanderlust Circus and Bella Balog of Three Leg Torso about their collaboration to present their adaptation of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake speaks with Mary Chimenko Hinkley about her show Gates of Venice, Pattern and Color at the Augen Gallery. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one when you go to kboo.fm and click where it says Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for a live interview conducted by KBOO reporter Jimmy Tardy. Good night, Sam.
Good night, Ross.
I'm joined by Dan Handelman, who's with Portland Cop Watch, which is a project of Peace and Justice Works, and Shauna Curfee, who's with the National Lawyers Guild and legal counsel for the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. We are talking about the upcoming fairness hearing regarding the Department of Justice lawsuit against the Portland Police Bureau regarding the Portland Police Bureau's excessive use of force on people who are experiencing a mental illness. Thanks for joining me, Dan and Shauna. I want to start out with some quotes from KGW's Kyle Eboshi. This is from November 7th. City of Portland announced an agreement Wednesday among its police force, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the police union that would settle a lawsuit that came after a 15-month U.S. Department of Justice review of the Bureau's practices and procedures, including its use of stun guns on people who had been determined to be suffering from a mental health crisis. Findings showed a pattern of excessive force. The agreement settles the matter, and it's coupled with a new collective bargaining agreement between the police force and police union. The city has agreed to hire a compliance officer to ensure the agreement is followed and form a community oversight board. The body would be chaired by the compliance officer, and it'll include 15 voting members and 5 advisory panelists. Dan and Shauna, let me ask either of you to talk about this board, how it will be chosen, and what its powers can be expected to be in light of the state of civilian oversight in Portland.
Well, what you're talking about is the Community Oversight Advisory Board. is not intended to be a police accountability board in the same sense that our independent police review division is. What it is supposed to be doing is overseeing the implementation of this agreement with the DOJ. And that board can't be chosen until after the compliance officer is hired, and the compliance officer probably won't get hired until the agreement gets put into the court. And so the agreement is going to be put in the court this coming Thursday, the 19th. And then the ball will start rolling on these other issues. So the COAB will not have very much power at all. All they're going to be doing is saying, we think that the police are following, the city is following this agreement or not. And then they present that information back to the public and to the DOJ, and hopefully somebody will listen and start doing what they're supposed to do, and the compliance officer will listen and do what they're supposed to be doing.
This is the Community Oversight Advisory Board. And so upcoming this Thursday is going to be...
when the judge sets the fairness hearing.
The date for the judge to set the fairness hearing.
Yes.
Regarding this agreement.
Yes.
So this is a tangled mess a little bit. It's something to work your way through. Fortunately, both Dan and Shauna have joined me today, and they have a lot of insight on this issue and understand some of the ways that it winds through what's going on. Shauna?
So just to add to what Dan said, what's going to happen on Thursday is the parties have been engaged in a long mediation process. Particularly the PPA has held up the implementation of the settlement agreement as they bargained with the city over their collective bargaining agreement, their separate labor rights. They've resolved those. They've tied those two things together, the settlement agreement and their collective bargaining agreement. And what we're going to be doing on Thursday is reporting to the court, or they're going to be reporting to the court, that they've resolved their differences with the city. And then, as Dan said, the court will be accepting the settlement agreement and setting a date for the fairness hearing.
Really, there's three hearings that are tied all together this week. And that one's on Thursday. And really, there's not a huge role for the public. I think I encourage people to come and watch that so they understand what the process is that's going on. Also, so there's two other things on Wednesday. Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock, City Council is considering the PPA bargaining agreement, the police association's bargaining agreement, and whether to accept their letter saying we reserve the right to argue about some points that are in the DOJ agreement, but generally it's okay to enter that into court. That's going to happen Wednesday morning. There's problems with the collective bargaining agreement that we think we're going to express to the city council, but we're probably not be able to do much to change that. Because of collective bargaining rules and other complications, there's probably not a lot the community can do about that right now, which is very frustrating, and I hate putting that message out, but I think that's where things are. However, Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock, the Independent Police Review Division, which they brought forward some proposed changes in the middle of October, October 23rd, I think it was, that were okay changes, but they didn't go far enough, and this community came forward and said, we want you to go farther. The chief came in that day and said, oh, wait, this is going too far. The system we have, the oversight system we have now, the IPR, is strong enough. We don't need to do all this. And he put the brakes on it. And so they're coming back Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock with a watered-down version of what the community's already said doesn't go far enough for an oversight system. And so we think that hearing about how to change our oversight system should wait till after the fairness hearing happens in February, because the judge could look at the agreement that the DOJ and the city came up with and say, you know what? This isn't fair. This is not going to solve the problem because your oversight system is still not strong enough. And he's less likely to do that if they make changes to it now. He will, you know, the city could establish facts on the ground, and he could just say, well, they've already made some changes. Let's see how that works. So our big message is we want people out at 2 o'clock Wednesday at City Council to say, let's put this off. Let's do it right. Let's fix the whole thing at once, but let's do it next year after the fairness hearing's done.
And these changes that were proposed in October, are these the same changes that the city auditor, LaVon Griffin-Vallad, has been championing?
That's correct. Yes. So one of them is great, that, you know, in theory, because it would allow our independent police review division, the professional staff that takes in people's complaints, to compel officers to testify them when there's an investigation into misconduct. However, we've been asking for that for years. We also knew that there's lots of legal complications to that, and you couldn't just flick a switch and make it happen. So they ran into those problems that we knew they would run into because they tried to just change the ordinance without all the moving parts that are necessary.
And that includes the union agreement.
The union contract, which is why, again, the union contract should be changed. But so, you know, so it's all kind of a big mess. I think Shauna can talk a little bit about why it may not be necessary for the pieces of the union contract that both prevent the IPR from doing what it needs to do and which allows the police up to a minimum of 48 hours to come in and talk to investigators. She can talk a little bit about why that's not something that the city should have left in the contract.
And this is regarding compelling officers to testify, correct?
In the lead up to the ratification of the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement that the city has with the Portland Police Association, the National Lawyers Guild sent a memo to city council members explaining that the timing of an interview, so when an interview takes place after an incident of misconduct or alleged misconduct, is not a mandatory subject of bargaining. In other words, the city could have sat down at that table and said, we're removing this and we're not discussing it with you further.
So the city is not required to bargain with the union on this timeline.
The city's position is, as a practical matter, those talks would not have gone farther. So in other words, they weren't willing to take that stand with the police union. But they were legally, our position, the NLG's position is, they were legally entitled to do so. They could have sat down and said, we're taking it away, and we're not discussing it with you further.
So in essence, what you're saying is that the city council is dropping its ball as the civilian oversight of the police department, in this case, in regard to its setting some things in stone that it is allowed to.
Yeah, I'm saying that the city as the employer, as management in this labor negotiation, capitulated on that issue when they didn't have to bargain over it at all.
The other issue has to do with the IPR, the Independent Police Review Division, where I was talking about, and whether or not they can conduct these investigations, including investigations into shootings and deaths, which is, I think, what's really important to the community. And that, you know, there's language in the agreement that could be interpreted in different ways, but I think the problem is if you're going to have language that could be interpreted in different ways, you should make it clear or take it out. And there, again, I think what Shauna found right, that...
Right, so the collective bargaining agreement says when the delay will not jeopardize the investigation. So there's some discretion. They don't always, in other words, management doesn't always have to comply with this 48-hour rule because the collective bargaining agreement says when the delay won't jeopardize an investigation. So then there, what Dan's saying is that that's not clear enough. They should have just eliminated it. It's just the city's trying to argue, well, we have this discretion. We can do it sooner if it looks like it'll jeopardize the investigation. But again, that's not sufficiently clear. And it still says the 48-hour rule applies in all other instances.
So at this point, any police officer involved would have 48 hours in which they're not required to testify unless there was something about this case that 48 hours would somehow jeopardize the resolution of this situation, whatever it could potentially be.
Right. And our position is, of course, in every case, giving somebody 48 hours to come up with their response is going to jeopardize the investigation. So why leave it in the collective bargaining agreement at all?
Okay. So again, we're getting back down to the ability of the civilian oversight to compel officers to testify and actually have some oversight.
Yep. Yeah. And just to make it clear, right now it's Internal Affairs that does those investigations, and they also are subject to that 48-hour rule. So regardless of who's doing the compelling, that 48-hour rule is there.
Right. So it's a multi-layered kind of problem here as far as police accountability. So this is going to be before City Council this coming Wednesday, the 18th at 2 p.m.
The contract is before the City Council at 10 a.m., but then the changes to IPR that would give them the power to compel testimony sort of is at 2 p.m., and that's what I was going to say, is that what they're proposing, what's going to be coming forward at 2 p.m. Wednesday, is that the IPR, when they want to investigate an officer misconduct, they have to get somebody from the police bureau to tell the officer to answer the questions. That's how things work now. There's actually very little change. The current way it works, and the director of IPR told counsel, this is crazy. He used that word, which is, you know, kind of derogatory. But in order to ask an officer a question right now, he has to have somebody from Internal Affairs say, I order you to answer this question. So instead of it happening on a question-by-question basis now, it'll happen for the whole investigative session where they sit down, somebody from the bureau says, you have to answer this person's questions, and then IPR can ask them. But the IPR itself won't have the power. They will still be completely dependent on the police.
We need to make sure that the public understands that what we're here doing right now today is trying to encourage you to come be a part of this process, because it is very complicated and we need people to be paying attention to this issue, because things are coming to a resolution and being set, quote, in stone, or at least precedents are being established in the coming week that are going to affect the long-term outcome of this overall process. And this is all in relation to this damning Department of Justice assessment of a pattern of excessive use of force by the Portland Police Bureau against people who are experiencing a mental health crisis.
Right. And what's disappointing is that the DOJ made a findings letter before the settlement agreement was ever entered into. And the findings letter described Portland police oversight system, the accountability system in our city, as Byzantine, ineffective. And so we were really looking for some real change to this oversight system. And it's been very disappointing that that's not what's happening now.
Go ahead, Nan.
Well, I was going to say, and in 2010, the city called together a stakeholder committee that made 41 recommendations, and about three of them had been put in place, and about two more of them will be put in place if the vote goes through on Wednesday, but that leaves 36 more floating out there. And we made this very clear to city council. We had people who sat on that stakeholder committee come to them in October and say, we have other stuff that needs to be done, and so far that message is falling on deaf ears. The auditor has not added anything to that proposal. And if, as I said, in fact, she's taken some things away.
And in the process of all this, we have had our charter review process in which many of these things were addressed and sidelined as that went along. So, again, Portland, you need to understand things are moving forward. And if you ever thought that police oversight was an issue of interest for you, we're here now reminding you Wednesday, 2 p.m. before City Council is your opportunity, one of your best opportunities to come before the powers that be and let them know that you're paying attention to this issue and that it matters to you. Absolutely. If there's anything else you guys want to...
Well, I just want to say there's... Under the auspices of the Independent Police Review is a citizen review committee of nine citizen volunteer members. And they're supposed to be getting more power. The DOJ agreement instructs the city to give them the ability to order more investigation. When somebody doesn't like the outcome of an investigation into misconduct, they can appeal to the Citizen Review Committee, known as the CRC. And right now, they can ask for more investigation. Three times in the last 2 years, they did that, and the city, IPR, and Internal Affairs said, nope, we're not going to do it. And the DOJ agreement that the city signed off on says they should get that power. For some reason, the auditor's proposal that's coming up on Wednesday doesn't include that power. So this is all about empowering the paid staff, the professional staff, and then disempowering the citizen volunteers who are like what most people would think of as our police review board.
Among that paid staff are a number of former law enforcement.
Not anymore. Used to be that way, but that's dropped off quite a bit. They hired three new investigators who are all from backgrounds that are not law enforcement. There's only one former police officer now out of the 11-member staff at IPR.
So, Shauna, how would you encapsulate this dynamic that's going on here? If you had to put it into polls, what are the different forces really seem to be shooting for here?
I would say that the police union has made police accountability in the city of Portland very, very difficult. And I'm not derogating people's labor rights. I certainly am pro-labor. But I think this union is exceptionally strong and that they are very reticent to change anything that would lead to more public involvement in police accountability. Even in settling their differences over the settlement agreement and the DOJ suit, they've reserved the right to grieve provisions in that settlement agreement that relate to officer questioning and officer oversight. So I think the police union is basically what's made this very difficult, and the city has not been willing to really take that on. The most important negotiations took place behind closed doors, so we don't know what trades happen as a practical matter during negotiations. What we do know is there is a discipline matrix in place now that was not in place before, and there are going to be annual performance reviews. Unfortunately, those annual performance reviews are not tied to discipline in any way. In other words,
why are they done?
That was the question we had for the city. So the city's response is, well, if there's a promotion at stake and everything else being equal, these performance reviews will be considered to decide between two people if everything else is equal in their file.
Because that happens all the time.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Right.
And then, yeah. And the performance evaluation will also only include complaints that have been sustained against the officer, not if they get multiple complaints that they say, well, it's a he said, she said situation, or if they get exonerated, like they found that the misconduct didn't happen. Those aren't going to be part of the evaluation. So even though when they stack up, you could probably see a pattern and what might want to do something about the officer's behavior, that's not going to be part of the performance evaluation because of what they wrote in the contract.
Anything else you guys want to add about this situation before we wrap up?
I just want to repeat what Dan said, that it's imperative that people get involved in this process. It's also, I think, important that people file complaints with independent police review when they do have a problem with officer misconduct, because if we don't use the system that we have in place, even though it has a lot of problems, it'll be hard for us to establish with the city that these problems exist and that police misconduct continues, and we know it does.
The form to register a complaint or to give an officer kudos for a job well done, it's both the same form. It's available online at portlandonline.gov. You can go into the auditor's section, it's there. If you go into the Portland Police Bureau section, it's there. They're also available at City Hall and distributed in various places around town. It's a fairly simple form for people to fill out. It's fairly straightforward, but at least, like Sean is saying, it provides some documentation that there's patterns of behavior going on, which would be a good supervisory tool. At least you would think that the supervisory staff, the sergeants especially, would want to be able to say, this particular officer is needing this type of retraining, is suitable for this type of role, et cetera, based on this evidence. And at this point, that just is not being utilized.
Well, not to confuse people more, but there may be another way where that happens. There's a thing that's called the employee information system, where those kind of things cumulatively do add up, and eventually you could get called into your supervisor's office, and that exists now before the performance evaluations. But the fact that they're separating them, that you know that EIS review might happen over on one side of the bureau, and then when they get their annual evaluation, that's not part of it. That doesn't make any sense.
So, right? And would the EIS include calls to the watch commander, say, for instance, and not these?